Hello and welcome to Cinemakers, Amy Heckerling. This is episode 47, Johnny Dangerously from 1984. See, I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Kara Gallo-Regan.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And you guys, this Fargan movie, I kind of hate this movie.
Oh man, that's disappointing.
I know that you really like it, and I was looking forward to it. We talked about it last week, and it just did not work for me.
It didn't really work for me either.
Even a little bit.
Oh no, it's a waking up in Reno reverse situation.
Like, I get what it's trying to do. Like, the best description I have of this movie is that it's like a Leslie Nielsen movie on 1/5 speed. Mm. It's like, it's a spoof, it's a send-up, it's a parody, but there's just, it's trying to also be like an actual gangster movie, I think, and like, it just, I don't think it works like that. I would rather have like, just throwing jokes at the wall and like, have a lot of them be dumb and bad, but like, I'd just rather have way more jokes. But there are stretches of this movie where nothing even remotely funny is happening on screen.
That's what I kind of liked about it. To me, I would describe it as a lost Mel Brooks script or something. I appreciated the fact that like it tried to also be like a normal movie at times, but I was actually quite impressed that she was able to just like maintain the pace of this thing. I hadn't seen this in like 30 years. I had almost forgotten all of it. I know, it's insane.
Like I'm 30 years old.
I saw this when I was like 8. Maybe that was part of it. Just like when I realized like what I was watching, everything just like sort of flooded back and like I just had a great time. I just had so much fun.
Well, one thing that we've learned on Wistful Thinking is that like 9 years old is a really special time where like if you see something that at like the age of 9 or if the character is like 9 years old, it is like indelible in people's hearts and minds. So that might have something to do with it. I didn't think it was that bad. I just like, not for me. not my thing.
Yeah, like I don't think it's a bad movie. I just think it's not funny enough.
What about Michael Keaton? Like, to me, I thought he was electric in this thing. Like, by the end of it, I was like,
I don't.
He's
really
fine.
I thought at the end I was like, man, he should have played Joker instead of Batman. Like, I thought he was on fire.
Yeah, no, he would make a good Joker. I think the other thing, and Joey, I don't know how much gangster genre stuff you've taken in. I've not seen a lot of like the original gangster stuff. I've just seen like weird parody stuff or like next generation trying to be that older stuff. I feel like I probably like missed a lot of the jokes that are really like steeped in the gangster genre or not. I'm not sure.
I think that's another difficulty of watching this movie 34 years after it came out, because like instead of just of only quote unquote only being 50 years from the era that they're parodying, we're now 80 years. And I've seen, like, I'm familiar with those kind of movies, and I feel like I've seen some of the bigger ones, but I'm not especially steeped in them. I get what they're doing. I just, it is a genre, it's a decade, it's something that I, like you, Kara, I don't know a ton about, and it just, it feels like I understand, like, kind of what they're going for, like, you know, mob boss and sort of caricatures and like why Iota and stuff like that. I don't have the nuance. Like, I was thinking, like, it'd be the equivalent today of like making a movie that, like what were the 60s known for cinematically? And I also, I was struggling to come up with that, like what the 60s were known for. I mean, other than like Alfred Hitchcock, I don't know. It's just, I think it's weird to do it 50 years after the fact. And I think it's also even weirder somehow to watch it 80 years or 30 years after it came out, like 80 years after the era that they're making fun of.
Yeah.
Or lovingly making fun of. I'm not sure. Like, it feels like this is the kind of thing where there's movies like today that I'm struggling now to come up with examples, but like where it's a movie that the filmmakers love and that it's a genre that they love and they want to send it up in like a loving way. Like, it feels like the people who made this, like the writers love these movies.
Yeah, definitely.
But I just don't know them enough to be like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, I love it.
And Heckerling also has spoken about just seeing Jimmy Cagney movies on TV all the time as a kid and really loving those. So like, I get that. It just wasn't for me.
I think you guys are onto something in that it's like, it's pretty far removed today from what it's trying to get at. And like, I like those old gangster films. I mean, they're more, I mean, I like them more as like film history. Like, I think, you know, cause just like it's early filmmaking and stuff. And that's kind of interesting. I love Cagney as an actor. I love like his filmography, but like, you know.
And Keaton is basically doing Cagney in this, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's very much Cagney. They even go to like a James Cagney movie at the end of the movie. I think that was maybe a step too far. But yeah, you know, like Little Caesar and stuff, and like with Edward G. Robinson, like this is definitely playing more off of those films. And I think like today's audience is just too sophisticated. Like we've seen Goodfellas, you know, we've been exposed to Scorsese and stuff. And like, you know, I would see him getting a huge kick out of this, right? Because these are the movies that like he kind of grew up on. And I think there's a bit of a generation gap. But I think for me as a kid, maybe what today also sort of clicked with me is just how Looney Tunes it is. Like, it is a live action cartoon. He may as well be Bugs Bunny to me. And so I settled into that, and I really, that just kind of like took me the rest of the way.
I had a friend come over and watch the last hour of this with me because I was watching, and then he came over and brought dinner over, and the two of us just watched it. And he's like, I feel like I would like this more if Kermit the Frog was the lead. And I was like, you know what? That actually is like a really good point. Like, I would, if Kermit was like in the lead of this movie, absolutely. Like, I would be all on board for that. But the fact that it's just Michael Keaton, like, when this movie gets really wildly visual, like when they hang Joe Piscopo by the hook on the back of the door and they like close and open the door, like, that's really funny.
Oh, that was Joe Piscopo.
It is Joe Piscopo.
Yeah, he's insane.
I knew he was in this, and I saw the movie, and I know who Joe Piscopo is and what he looks like, and somehow did not realize that was him.
This was one that I was glad that my friend was watching with me, because he's older, he's closer to Mike's age, and he was saying, oh, that's that guy, that's this guy, that's that guy. And like he recognized, you know, Mr. Hand was the newspaper salesman guy.
Yeah,
What I didn't recognize, my friend didn't recognize, is that Griffin Dunne, who is still an actor today, plays his brother. Like, you know, he's arguably more prolific than anyone else in this movie at all. Like, he's in everything.
Yeah, he directed one of my favorite movies, Practical Magic.
Oh, he directed that?
He directed that, weirdly.
Oh, wow. Speaking of Scorsese, he was in After Hours. He's the star of that. I mean, American Werewolf in London. I mean, he's in some great movies, yeah.
He also made an okay documentary about Joan Didion, who happens to be his aunt.
Oh, yeah, this is pretty stacked cast. Peter Boyle's in here, you know, like he's fantastic.
And I guess that's kind of the point, but like Peter Boyle in like the opposite role that I've come to know him as, like... I know Peter Boyle as like this sort of genteel old man, right? And then to see him in here, I know Peter Boyle, I think we even talked about this on another episode, Mike, like he might have been in a movie that we talked about on another podcast, but...
He's in Honeymoon in Vegas. He plays the chief in Hawaii.
Oh, yes. Because he is Clyde Bruckman in Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose, which is one of my favorite X-Files episodes of all time. And I love him as this, like, kind old man, and to see him as, like, a mob boss, I guess that's the joke, in a way, that, like, he's, like, this sort of kind old man who also happens to be a mob boss, but, like, he kind of seems like a good mob boss, like a good guy?
Yeah, like, he did Young Frankenstein, right? So, I mean, he had, like, some comedy chops under his belt, and, like, this is sort of right up his alley, I feel. Like, I mentioned Mel Brooks earlier, and this has that sort of flavor to it, so, but that's really interesting, like, how he's, like, the nicest mob boss in the world, like, he, you know, sends money back to the public, like, gives his enforcers cookies when they're feeling down and stuff. Like, is that Heckerling? Is that her touch, like, making these men softer? You know, like, you would usually think of gangsters to be so tough and everything, but, like, no, like, you know, I could picture these guys knitting or something.
I don't know, but I was thinking about how kind of femme his apartment is, like, even before he gets married, when there's just like girls all around, it's all of this satin and like beautiful flowers everywhere. And I wasn't sure, like, is that a thing in gangster movies? Do they have really like posh apartments?
I think just the opulence to a degree is what it was sort of getting at.
But like more than opulence, it had like, it felt like distinctly femme to me, which I found interesting. And maybe that's part of what you were talking about.
Because I think the interesting thing to say here, because I don't know if that was her touch or not, but the interesting thing that I think, Kara, you mentioned last time is that this movie, not necessarily flopped. The budget was like $9 million. I think it made like $17 million at the box office. Like it, you know, unless it had a crazy marketing budget, made its money back. But it flopped enough with critics that she was like, okay, I'm done directing things that other people write. I only want to direct things that I write now. And so this was like kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. Like, obviously, Fast Times was great, but she didn't write that. This was written by four dudes, one of whom has a writing credit on Blazing Saddles. The same guy also wrote Yes, Giorgio, that Luciano Pavarotti movie Houses Get Meat Covered, which is atrocious. So this guy is really all over the map. But this was the movie where she was like, okay, I'm done. Like, I want to direct my own visions now. So maybe these were her touches, maybe they're not, I don't know. But I think, you know, in terms of the Cinemakers thing, like Christopher Nolan, for the most part, he and his brother always wrote his movies, right, Mike? And Soderbergh usually wrote his, or he had a couple different writers. I think he had a couple of writers who, like, he sort of went back to a lot. But here, from the next movie on out, or at least most of it, is going to be stuff she writes and she'll actually have control over. So I don't know how much of this was her touch and how much wasn't, but, you know, let's give her credit for the good things.
Well, there's one thing I really want to give her all the credit in the world for, and it may be the point where a lot of people might have turned on this movie, especially in 1984, and that's the instructional video, Your Testicles in You, where she just got dicks into this movie, like, for like a solid 3 minutes. There's just, like, all they're talking about, which is, like, huge testicles and all this kind of, like, sex talk and everything. Like, that was impressive to me.
My favorite thing about that scene is just thinking about how that was the film that was just on Michael Keaton's projector. Like, for whatever reason, that was the last thing he watched. You know what I mean? Like, he either shows it to so many people, like, that character, aside from the fact that he has a projector in his bedroom, he just has that film queued up that he shows it or he watches it a lot. Like, that's a very weird character quirk that I kind of love.
I think he was trying to talk his brother out of premarital sex.
Oh, I know why he was doing it there, but I'm just saying, like, he didn't prep it. It was just ready.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I hear what you mean. Right.
It's like if I came over your house and you're like, here, let me show you something. You just, like, fired up your DVD player and that was in the DVD player. Like, it's not like you went to your shelf and got it off the shelf. It was just in there already. Be like, why are you watching this?
Just very resourceful.
Interestingly, this is another movie that has a subplot about trying to get laid.
Although, I think that's kind of maybe where the similarities end. I understand that this is a spoof and a send-off of, like, an era that was far less kind to women than the 80s. Not that, you know, the 80s were necessarily great to women, but they were better than the 30s. But at one point when his brother is getting married and they ask his bride-to-be what she wants to do, and she's like, well, I'm his gal and he makes all the decisions, so, like, it's up to him. And I'm like, oh, like, these characters in the last movie, you know, like, we talked about how Phoebe Cates and Jennifer Jason Leigh had, like, all this, you know, agency, and they have these, like, frank, honest, and open conversations that were such, like, a breath of fresh air. And here we have, like, one of the only women in the movie just like, well, I'm a woman and I don't get a say, so I don't really care what happens. And I was like, oh, boy. Like, I get, again, that it's a parody, but it was rough, a little rough.
That is the joke, though, because even Michael Keaton's character, he scoffs at that answer, you know, and everyone kind of looks at each other like, in this day and age, kind of with an expression on their face. So, I mean, I think they were trying to go for something that just didn't land, where it was like, yeah, that's, you know, the oppression of that age and how ingrained it is and all that kind of thing. But, like, yeah, and even in the 80s, they weren't, you know, that far removed from that. So they could have gone a little deeper. What I really liked is their mother, Ma Kelly, to me. She steals this entire movie.
Yeah, she's great. Terrible Irish accent, but she's pretty good.
Just, again, what they're able to get away with her saying with her character, like the idea that she comes out as bisexual in the movie. She keeps her vibrator in her purse like it's no big deal.
A modern woman.
Right, well, yeah, just like very progressive sort of attitude. And it's funny how she's living in the 30s and she's just like more advanced thinking, modern thinking.
This was one of the very first PG-13 movies. So the MPAA, I mean, we talk about it a couple different times on a couple different podcasts about how they sort of have what seemingly arbitrary rules and whatnot, but they used to have only PG and R, and like movies like I think Poltergeist and Raiders are all PG when they probably should be PG-13 or whatever, but this is one of the very first. I guess they were able to get away with a little bit more is what I'm trying to say. The fact that they had this, like, this sort of newer designation that they could have, you know, more risque topics or sort of more unexpected conversations or set pieces or whatever, just because it wasn't just for kids. Like, there was a specific designation, like, oh, you have to be a certain age to watch this. Or
I guess that's fortunate. They're able to sort of, like, push the envelope a little further than you would have if it just had to be, like, marketed as PG. I think they also get away with it a little bit more because it's like a full-on parody thing. The whole thing with Maroney in his dialect. Like, I know they're making fun of like a foreign accent and everything, but it's actually, for what they have to do, it's kind of clever, because he's able to say like the F word and swear and all this kind of stuff, and like do it so much to the degree that to me it just sounds like he's saying fucking. That is just a really clever way to get away with using the F word. So either having to tone it down from an R or up from a PG, they did a pretty good job.
This was a movie that, like, I struggled to take notes on. It was a movie where I was, like, watching it very intently, because I was like, what am I missing? Like, I was trying to decode the movie while I was watching it. I did like that the movie started with, at least the version I watched, which apparently wasn't on all versions, it starts with a Weird Al song.
Yeah, my first note is, hell yeah, Weird Al.
Yeah.
And it's a song that he wrote for this movie.
There's multiple versions of this?
So it wasn't on the home video release, or at least one version of the home video release, because of legal reasons.
Oh, rights issues. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because this movie...
it's hard to find. It's in print. You can get a DVD of it.
But it's not streaming anywhere. Like, you can't rent or buy this streaming. It's not for free or anything. Like, you have to buy a physical or find a physical copy. It's always weird. Like, I feel like everything is available, and you come across a movie like this, and it's like, oh, I guess everything's not available.
It's weird. I mean, just in light of that, it's, like, Michael Keaton, and, like, this was the era in which he was really taken off. Like, not only is this a movie from my childhood, but, like, Mr. Mom and Gung Ho, you know? I never saw Night Shift until I was a little older. That's more of, like, an R-rated movie, I think. But, like, yeah, I remember him as, like, coming up around this time. Like, he was just the man. Like, he was funny as hell, and so... and he's, like, still huge, you know? He's Birdman, he's the Vulture.
He did Birdman 4.
It's just weird that his films aren't all streaming or readily available or easy to find. And then that there's a Weird Al song on here, too. That's a deep cut. Like, I don't remember that.
One thing that I really did like about this movie is that this is, in a way, like the Princess Bride movie that you covered on Whistle Thinking Kara, that it's mostly, almost entirely told in a flashback to a young boy. And I like... a lot when it got super meta, when the screen gets like wavy and wiggly, and he's like, oh, this will go in a couple seconds, and the kid's like, what are you talking about? Like, I love that. And then like that just sort of gets dropped.
Yeah, because right before that also it seems like it's like a title showing you that it's 1936 and a car pulls in to the frame and actually crashes into it. It was like a physical piece of the set.
Like, that's great.
And they don't do that for the rest of the movie.
There was one part, Michael Keaton talks to the cameras about not having sex or something. Like, he breaks the fourth wall. Like, I want more of that. Like, for a movie to do that, and I feel like do that so well, like, play with, not, like, genre conventions or, like, of the 30s, but just of movies in general. Like, I want more of that because what is there works so well, but it's just not there enough for my liking.
I hear you totally. I would love more of that, too. But I'd also just think or feel like that style of comedy just... wasn't really in the forefront yet, like, especially as much as it is today with shit like Deadpool, you know, for crying out loud, like, it's excessive. So, like, to even get these little moments like that, I think we're lucky that they were clever enough to write that stuff in, because even when you get to stuff like Airplane and Naked Gun, like, he doesn't, like, Frank Drebin never really turns directly to the camera and, like, has a monologue or anything like that. So it was sort of few and far between at the time, whereas now it's sort of widespread. But those are definitely, yeah, you've pinpointed some highlight moments for sure during this. One of my favorite moments is when they flash back to the pet shop in between the stories, and he's putting the price tag stickers on the puppies. Yeah. Like, all the little things, like, he's doing at the pet shop, like polishing the turtles, like, that stuff to me was just fantastic.
Like, when we first see Danny DeVito, who is the DA until he gets killed, when we first are introduced to him, Michael Keaton's brother gets a job as the assistant DA, and he goes in there, and they don't make any note of this. I don't know if either of you caught it. I'm guessing at least one of you probably did. Under Danny DeVito's desk, sticking out the front, are just a pair of women's feet.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like yeah. He's getting a blowjob under there. He doesn't go back to it. They don't reference it, but, like, it's these little background gags that are really funny. It just, I hate almost 100% of the dialogue. It's like everything else I love. But it's like the dialogue just doesn't work. Like, there's not enough jokes there. Like, the little background things, the way that, like, it's meta, like, that's peppered in nicely. It's just, I wish the dialogue was more reflective of that kind of comedy.
I feel like there was a lot in the dialogue, but I also got the distinct feeling that I was missing a lot of jokes.
Yeah, it's very quick, I felt. Like, that was something I was surprised about, like, just how rapid-paced it was. There's a couple lines of dialogue that stick out to me, but what happens up is some of it sort of peters out throughout the movie, and it, you know, might come back here and there, but there's one part in the beginning where it's snowing, and his mom's like, man, this is like the worst July in history.
Yeah.
And then it's her birthday, and, you know, she's depicted as being, like, very elderly. And they're like, oh, she's like, it's my 29th birthday. I hope I reach 30. So, like, those landed for me. But again, yeah, there wasn't as much of that. You know, they were sort of also, like you said earlier, Joey, trying to be, like, an actual gangster movie. So part of the comedy, possibly, what they were playing at was just mimicry of those types of movies at the time, and just, you know, how ridiculous it is to be like, hey, I got a gun, check out my gun, see? Like, yeah, it's just the way we talk, right? Instead of, like, target practice, it's like, let's go help some old ladies cross the street. So I think we're missing part of the joke in that sense, possibly, is that part of the parody is just straight up, like, mimicry and flattery.
There were a bunch of really ableist jokes or gags that were upsetting. And I did actually, like, just last week watch Young Frankenstein, and, like, which was a movie that I loved as a kid and was really put off by the amount of extremely ableist jokes that are in that. So I guess that was just, like, a thing of the time. Like, there still are a lot of ableist jokes in film, but not to the extent that there were in these two movies.
Like, especially, like, every time you're saying, like, when Mr. Hand gets hit in the head, it's like, I can see again, but now I can't hear, and now I can see and hear, but now I don't remember who I am, like, that kind of stuff.
Even, like, his invalid mother, right? Like, every scene, it's like, she's got a different problem physically, like, some kind of medical issue.
As somebody who frequently has lots of new medical issues, that to me wasn't really the joke. The joke was the doctor, as he's leaving, being like, there's some bad news, blah, 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 it's going to cost, and then each time, it's, like, an increasing amount of money, but he frames it as like, but today special, we have the low price of whatever it is
of $7,500 to fix the blocked salivary gland. Yeah
So that actually didn't really read as that ableist, but there's, like, another part where Joe Piscopo, like, pulls up and parks in a accessible parking space, and the person that's with him is like, no, that's a handicapped space, and he says, I'm handicapped, I'm psychotic, and, like, that's fucked up. There's also, at the beginning of the movie, like, the flashback, like, back to when he was a kid, you see him, like, walking down the street, like, pulling pranks on people, and one of the pranks is that he cuts the leash of a blind man seeing eye dog.
Oh, yeah, that's how I knew I was going to hate that character of Young Piscopo.
Yeah, and that's just, like, a few of the examples, but they were pretty egregious, really stood out to me. Because, like, all of them, like, they could have just not done that joke, and it would have been fine. Like, if they just had literally anything else happen.
Yeah, I think that also comes as a consequence of just filling the frame with everything you've got, too. It's like, and that can just turn people off, yeah, pull back a little bit, yeah. Because even for my taste, like, that is insensitive, and, like, this does sort of do too much. It is in its own right excessive, too, and I think that's why for critics it probably failed, because they just were, like, exhausted by it.
Exhausting is a good word to use for that. I mean, I was already exhausted when I was watching it, so I can't say how much of it was the movie and how much of it was I'm just tired, but it felt exhausting while I was watching it.
Well, what I can say is that this movie is the same length as Fast Times and feels like an hour longer.
Much longer. Yeah.
No, I didn't think it felt that. Well, I liked it more, so. But to me, it didn't fly by quite as fast, but it was quick.
I appreciate that she has made, you know, two 90-minute movies. Like, that's, I feel like that's a skill that directors just don't have, is to be able to tell, like, a concise story.
Oh, boy, you're telling me. And actually, that did go into my consideration of choosing Amy Heckerling over another director. It was, like, how many two-hour movies has she made? Or, like, over two-hour movies? Because that's really my threshold.
You know, I'm able to watch five movies in a row, but, like, I still would much rather watch a 90-minute movie than a two-hour. Like, I'd rather watch a movie that's the appropriately length. I'll say that. Like, Mandy is really long, but Mandy feels like it's supposed to be 2 hours. You know what I mean? Like that. Like that. There's so much going on.
I could use, like, another half hour of Fast Times if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah, they could have, but, like, at the same time, if there was that other half hour, we probably would have been like, nah, they could have cut, like, 30 minutes in the middle.
I think we're all saying that this is too long.
Oh, boy. You know, if we're playing the real bad, like, how do you fix it? Like, I think you gotta throw more jokes at it.
Well, no, you'd have to, like, cut some out, right? I mean, it goes a little, that's, for me, it goes a little too far.
Yeah, I think so.
You think cut jokes out?
Oh, yeah, you could probably trim this down.
Yeah, because even though I wasn't getting a lot of the jokes, I knew that they were jokes, and it was just, like, too much, all, like, back to back to back.
Okay.
You might be able to cut out the whole, unfortunately, even though he gives a great performance, Joe Piscopo role, right? Because that's like the C story going on, is that he figures out that Johnny and Tommy are brothers and they're on the opposite sides of the law.
Wait, Johnny and Tommy. Oh, hi.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Sorry, I don't know what you're talking about, but my brain got sidetracked.
As much as I loved it, was that Mary Lou Henner who...
Yeah.
Yeah, like, she's amazing in this, and I don't want to, you know, take more roles away from women or anything, but, like, again, like, if we're looking to trim places, like, you know, you could probably condense a little bit of that storyline more and...
Yeah, or just, like, either give her more to do or cut her out, you know?
Right, yeah, make her more... integrate her earlier and have her be there more and do more. But, I mean, yeah, there's ways.
Because I feel like if you cut Joe Piscopo out, you could then have Tommy realize that his brother is the DA as opposed to learning from Joe Piscopo, right? Like, you can just avoid that altogether. Although I did, you know, it's such a dumb joke, but I love that, you know, they wait until they get married because, you know, we talked about, you know, your testicles and you, they wait until they get married to have sex, and then they go to the closest spot, like, you know, they waited for this grand moment, and then they just go to the janitor's closet, and then he finds out he's so dedicated to his job that he runs away, and then that janitor just comes and, like, singing, like, an old, like, Christian gospel song or something, and then sees, I guess, presumably a naked woman, and then just sings Hallelujah, which consent is an issue, but I just thought that was a funny little, not sight gag. I'm like, why are we hovering on this janitor's closet? And then the janitor just strolls in like, oh, wow, okay, now I get it.
Yeah, like, everything is a bit, and, like, everything ends with a button, and they go for quantity, not quality all the time. So, like, I think there's something here, there's jokes here for everybody that land differently for each person. So, for me, one of my favorite jokes, and this is super stupid, is when Johnny goes back to the old neighborhood, and everyone calls him Johnny Dangerously, and he's like, gather around, and he's like, what did I tell you? And they all sort of recite back in unison that you're not Johnny Dangerously, you're, you know, this and that. And he's like, that's right. And then the Pope's there. He's like, and it's Dom DeLuise. And I mean, it's just so irreverent and stupid. And I just love that part.
But that feels like it belongs in a different movie. To me, it did. Like, it's close.
I don't know. It feels like Family Guy-esque or Simpson-esque or
yes,
something like that. Like, it is a little out of bounds of where they go.
Yeah, that's like Peter Griffin saying, hey, this is like that time I met the Pope. And, like, you know, it's that. Like, exactly. That's a good call.
There was one extremely nerdy joke that I enjoyed, which is when he's about to be executed, I guess, but then escapes from prison. The priest that's there, supposedly reading him his last rites, is speaking what most people would just assume is Latin, but he's actually just, like, saying a bunch of words that end in US and, like, other Latin suffixes.
Antimeridium, postmeridium, Uncle Meridium.
Yeah. Who missed the bus? I missed the bus. You missed the bus. That made me laugh really hard as somebody who took too much Latin.
You know, not too far removed in terms of, you know, words and English language and conjugation and stuff. There was a line that I loved, which doesn't really pay off, but a woman's like, hey, you know your last name's an adverb? He's like, yeah, I guess it is. Like, that's it. But, like, I just love that, like, that's called out.
He's like, I kind of like that. Yeah.
It's just like this weird, dumb observation. I was like, yeah, all right.
I also really like when they go to the movies towards the end and his mother goes to the concession stand and orders popcorn, milk duds, and a white fish.
I think by that point, I was just like, I'm not on board really with this movie. And that didn't, like, I didn't laugh at that, but, like, it's stuff like that that it felt like there was a lot of, like, whenever they acknowledge that, like, we're in a different time period and kind of anything goes, I think it worked well. Like, there's the line where his brother's like, how am I ever going to get laid in 1930? Like, the fact, like, that they call it out. I feel like you're making a movie 50 years after the fact. The more you call attention to it, it almost seems antithetical. But, like, the more you call attention to it, I think the funnier it is. At least that worked for me. I don't know if it worked for everybody, but whenever they call that, like, isn't it weird that, like, we're in 1930 or whatever? Like, that worked for me, I think, generally more often than not.
I agree with that. I like that, too, where it's, like, they're sort of acting like it was 1984, but they're clearly, you know, like, in the 1930s. Like, I like when Johnny and Lil are, like, walking and talking and dreaming about the future and stuff.
They walk all the way to New Jersey.
So he's like, where the hell are we? But they're talking about, like, you know, stuff people in, like, the 50s and 60s talked about, like, raising the nuclear family. They're like, we'll get a little house with a white picket fence and have little kids, and I'll wave hi to the neighbor and, like, fix the car and all this stuff. And I was like, that's funny to me because they're just acting like it's today, not like it's then. I like that part about it.
I hate to say it already in this podcast, but I think I've run out of notes, things to say about this movie.
Well, that happens we have good movies to talk about. We usually talk about them less.
I don't think that's why I have them out of notes myself. You know, I don't think I love this movie so much. I just was engrossed in it.
I'm joking.
Wait. I have one. Also, when he was in prison, his prison uniform is fantastic. It's like this couture version of what the other guys are wearing. The stripes are thinner. They're a darker blue. And he has this little ascot thing and this like three-piece jumpsuit that he's wearing. It's fantastic. I appreciated that.
And he's eating sushi.
Yeah, also he's eating sushi.
I wanted to bring up the wardrobe too, because at one point when Mary Lou Henner is doing her song and on the piano, the bottom of her skirt flips up and it's like red.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
I thought that was so awesome. I was like a magic trick or something. I'm sure it's very common, but it was a really cool effect and it made me think of wardrobe.
You know what makes me a little bit sad? Speaking of Mary Lou Henner, you guys might have heard this, but she famously has a photographic memory. And so she remembers everything about this movie. And so I feel bad for her.
No.
Sorry, I just had to say that.
That's funny, though. Oh, I did want to shout out, though. This is the second time Taylor Negron has showed up as a delivery man.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, RIP Taylor Negron. But hilarious as a delivery man. Two movies in a row.
I just looked while we were talking, and every single one of Amy Heckerling's movies is an hour 38 or shorter.
God bless. What a hero.
All right. Way to hit the target, really. Like, she is a marksman.
Which is truly not the hero that we deserve, but the hero that we need right now. Especially coming off of Christopher Nolan. I don't want to prejudge Amy Heckerling's movies, but just knowing what I know about Christopher Nolan's movies, like movies that I like way more, but he made all, toward the end, it was all like 220, 240, 245, like just long ass movies.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you don't have anyone to say no to you. And to be like, hey, you could lose about 40 minutes in the middle. I think it's really fantastic that she manages to keep it brief.
The one thing I also wanted to point out was that we were just saying about how, or I brought up earlier about how she wanted to only direct things that she wrote, but the next movie that we're doing, National Lampoon's European Vacation, she does not have a writing credit on. She might have collaborated with John Hughes, I don't know, but he's got the story by and the screenplay by credit on that one. So I've only seen Christmas Vacation in that series, so I don't know.
Oh, really?
Oh, and I've also seen the Jennifer Aniston, Jason Sudeikis remake. Does that count?
No, by no means. I've never seen
that. Yeah, with Emma Roberts as the daughter and some boy as the son.
Stop talking. Well, I mean, you know, that series went downhill way before the remake. So, I mean, the National Lampoon series in general, it survived a long time just off of the good graces of the Animal House name, I think. And then, you know, we got a lot of hard-to-follow National Lampoon movies. But Vacation series, pretty solid.
So I'm looking at the IMDb of the woman who was the costume designer on this. Her name is Patricia Norris, and it looks like she's worked with David Lynch a lot. She's done costumes and production design for Twin Peaks and Lost Highway.
Interesting. Jordan's favorite, David Lynch, Lost Highway.
Joey, if you recall, one of Soderbergh's like friends was, he was like a set dresser for Lynch movies, like for Twin Peaks and stuff. So if you go back and listen to like early Cinemakers, I think he's the guy who's the cult leader. He's like the L. Ron Hubbard in Schizopolis. And we were like going into his IMDb and stuff. And so like, oh, he ended up working with David Lynch a lot as like a set dresser.
So like I said, you know, the next movie that we're doing is European Vacation, written by John Hughes. But then both Look Who's Talking movies, Clueless, Vamps, I think maybe everything from here on out that she directs is her screenplay. So we're not quite there yet, but we are beginning to enter, I guess, what our sort of our pure true vision of Cinemakers was, right, Mike, where it's like the auteur vision that she writes and she directs, that this is her, you know, for better or worse, these are her movies. But next week, same bat time, same bat channel, right after, I think this episode comes out the week of Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving to everyone. But after Thanksgiving, we will come back with one more non-Heckerling written movie, and then it's just from there on out, it's all stuff that she's written. Karen, do you have any other notes about Johnny Dangerously before we wrap up and close up shop?
That their father was a criminal who was executed by the state, and his mother keeps a photograph of him, like, on the electric chair, framed on the table. And I thought that was really funny. She says to Johnny Dangerously's brother, your father always wanted you to be a lawyer, and then they cut to the photo of the father in the electric chair. So I thought that was hilarious.
I like that they even would take a picture of a guy in an electric chair.
Yeah. Joe Piscopo had a really great line, like, towards the beginning, and I forget what the middle of it was, the middle of the joke was, but he said something to the effect of, dames are put on this earth to steal our energy, do something else, and laugh at us when they see us naked. It was a really good joke.
Mike, any other last thoughts about Johnny Dangerously? Sorry to maybe put a buzzkill of sorts on this. I mean, I don't think it's bad. It just didn't work. And I think comedies are difficult to A, talk about, but B, if it's not working, I mean, it's hard to rebound from that. So
no, I'm fine. No, that's cool. I mean, I still liked it a lot. Just some quick key moments I just wanted to mention was I loved when he was dancing for his girlfriend and he's like jitterbugging and he goes into full on break dancing.
Oh, yeah.
Like that just blew my mind. I thought that was hilarious. The judge was the skipper from Gilligan's Island, and then he was also like the police chief. Like they cut back to him at one point, and he's still at like the judge's like area, but he's wearing a cop uniform and talking on the radio. I thought that was great. And then just, I don't know. I mean, this just has to be a sheer coincidence, but there's a toilet bomb in this, like there is in Lethal Weapon 2. Peter Boyle goes in to take a dump apparently, or use the toilet, and then like the bathroom explodes. And if you haven't seen Lethal Weapon 2, at one point a character sits down on the toilet and notices that it's rigged with a bomb. That's it though. Otherwise, like I was really surprised how little I recalled of this movie.
Well, you saw it 30 years. Mike, you've seen literally thousands of movies since you saw Johnny Dangerously the first time.
You know what it is? And I haven't seen it since. So I guess that's why. Most movies I've seen as a kid, I've seen again. And it's just really strange to me, I guess, that I just haven't seen it since I was a kid.
Do you remember? Did you like it as a kid?
Yeah, I did. I don't know why I didn't see it more often as a kid, but I did like it.
Wait, did you say that you saw it in theaters or just like you rent it?
No. It was just on TV. Like on HBO. Yeah, it was just, I really enjoyed it this time. So, I mean, it's got issues, definitely, like things are dating it, like jokes and stuff like that. But I think for the time, like it's really solid.
Well, this really turned into an episode of
Wistful Thinking. It truly did, but not for me and you, Kara, just for Mike.
Sometimes it's really only for one person.
As long as it matters to somebody, I guess, is the point. But for all things Cinemakers and Wistful Thinking, and all of our close to 25 shows now that we've announced Hanks and Cruise, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. I don't think I mentioned this last time, but you can now sign up for a Cage Club monthly newsletter that I write and send out on the first of the month every month. Only once a month, you will not get overwhelmed. Because we have so many shows on the network that all have so many things going on, if you want to make sure that you don't miss out on anything, go to cageclub.me/newsletter and fill out the form, and I will send you a newsletter the first of the month every month, and just stay up with the best of the best of the network. I pick my editor's picks, if you will, of favorite episodes from each show of the month, and just, you know, the biggest news. So we are a couple days away from, I guess, December 1st. Sign up and get a newsletter soon. Email cinemakers@cageclub.me. Say hi. Let us know what you think of Amy Heckerling so far. Again, we might not get to these for a while because we're recording these a little bit in advance, but we will read them at some point, so just drop us a line and say hi.
Yeah, and if you want to ask us about or talk about Soderbergh or Nolan or The Collective or Fede Alvarez or anyone else that we've covered.
The Cinemakers at Cage Club to me, just drop us a note and say hi. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Kara Gail O'Regan.
And we'll see you next time for National Lampoon's European Vacation right here on Cinemakers.
Goodbye!